From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Jeffrey Canada tells us about working with poor inner-city children, the children he describes as the handgun generation. They live in a war zone, and his lessons include what to do if someone tries to shoot you in a drive-by. Canada runs the Riedland Centers for Children and Families in Harlem. He grew up in the South Bronx. He's written a new memoir that he describes as a personal history of violence in America. Also today, linguist Jeffrey Nunberg tunes in to talk radio. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Bosnian Serbs say they're freeing some hostage UN peacekeepers they're holding. A news agency run by the Bosnian Serbs says a bus loaded with 58 UN troops is on the Bosnian-Serbian border. There's been no confirmation of this report. NPR's Andy Bowers is in Sarajevo. He says if the peacekeepers are released, Serbian President Slobodan Milosevic will get much of the credit.
Slobodan Milosevic has been taking the lead on this issue. He's been getting a lot of points with the Western community because twice now he's intervened and apparently been able to be the deciding factor in convincing his former patrons, the Bosnian Serbs, to release the hostages they've been holding. The Bosnian Serbs have been looking at these men as men and women as insurance against any more NATO airstrikes. So for Milosevic to actually be able to play a role in that helps the Western community, helps his image in the Western community.
Meanwhile, the Pentagon says a beeper thought to be held by a downed U.S. fighter pilot is no longer transmitting. A U.S. fighter pilot shot down last Friday over northern Bosnia is still missing. If he survived the plane crash, rescuers should be able to locate him with the transmitter. That hope is now fading. Also, a U.S. envoy has reported being unable to win Serbia's president over. Western diplomats say envoy Robert Fraser hasn't been able to persuade Serbian President Milosevic to recognize Bosnia. The goal was to get Serbia to recognize Bosnia and undercut the rebel Serbs fighting the Bosnian government. The French defense minister has strongly suggested today, based on the advice of military experts, France might resume nuclear testing. The environmental group Greenpeace reacted by announcing it will carry out a protest. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
Defense Minister Charmillon said a panel of military experts called on France to resume testing to maintain the credibility of the country's arsenal. The panel initially made this recommendation a year ago, but the president at the time, François Mitterrand, ignored its advice and chose to continue the moratorium. An updated report has now been given to the current president, Jacques Chirac, who has said he would follow the advice of military experts. The panel said less than 10 tests should be carried out before next year. The New Zealand government warned France not to resume testing, while Greenpeace said it would send its ship Rainbow Warrior No. 2 to the South Pacific to protest. 10 years ago, French agents blew up the first Rainbow Warrior during a Greenpeace anti-testing campaign. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
A press secretary for evangelist Billy Graham says the preacher collapsed during a luncheon speech today in Toronto, Canada. The spokeswoman only says Graham fainted while giving the speech. She would not comment on his condition, but she says a statement will be released shortly. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up nearly 8 points at 4,484. This is NPR. Voters in Denver are going to the polls to choose the city's next mayor. Mark Roberts reports from Denver.
Both incumbent Mayor Wellington Webb and his challenger, City Councilwoman Mary DeGroat, voted early today. Both campaigned almost nonstop Monday in a last-minute effort to influence voters and persuade people to come out to vote. Voter turnout is especially important for Mayor Webb. In May, DeGroat beat Webb by 97 votes, forcing today's runoff election. Political analysts say Webb's supporters may have assumed the mayor would win the first election and did not vote. DeGroat's support, on the other hand, is strongest in Denver's mostly white neighborhoods, where people consistently turn out to vote in higher numbers than those in minority neighborhoods. For the mayor to win re-election, he must get voters to the polls in the city's minority community, where he has his greatest support. For National Public Radio, I'm Mark Roberts in Denver.
A report says last year's strong economy fueled the creation of new companies across the United States. The business information group Dun & Bradstreet reports the number of incorporated businesses in the United States rose 5% last year. Dun & Bradstreet reports strong growth has created new business opportunities for each of the past 3 years, and that mirrors a trend last seen in the mid-1980s. Parts of South Carolina are under a flash flood watch. What's left of what was Hurricane Allison is moving across the state. Weather forecasters downgraded Allison from a hurricane to a tropical storm to a tropical depression. Allison moved across northern Florida and Georgia yesterday. It spawned a tornado on Hilton Head Island in South Carolina. There's a big merger in the offing in the beer industry. Belgium's biggest brewery is offering nearly $2 billion for Canada's John Labatt. The offer tops one already made for Labatt by a Canadian investment group. Labatt's board recommends shareholders accept the Belgian offer, which should be presented next week. The deal would create the world's third largest brewery behind Anheuser-Busch and Heineken. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Jeffrey Canada calls the young people he works with the handgun generation, a generation of children growing up under the conditions of war, a war that doesn't end. Violence is nothing new, he says, but violence in our inner cities is getting worse because there's too many guns, too much crack, too few jobs, too little hope. Canada has worked with poor inner-city children for about 20 years. He's the president of the Reedland Centers for Children and Families in Harlem, a program of schools and community centers providing safe havens for children. Canada teaches children to avoid violence. He also teaches them self-defense through his martial arts classes. Canada grew up in the South Bronx. He's written a new book which he describes as a personal history of violence in America, called Fist, Stick, Knife, Gun. He told me guns in the hands of children are even more dangerous than guns in the hands of professional criminals.
The problem with young people with guns is that, A, they're impulsive. Two, they tend to panic and shoot wildly. Three, most of them have never shot a gun really at a target before, so anyone who's close by is liable to get shot. And four is, you know, one of the things that happens is they get so angry so quickly. And then if you were to talk to them 2 hours later, they're not angry anymore. They're not that angry anymore. So this impulsivity means that they often will come out and shoot first and think later. What it's led to is really something which is even worse than many of the movies, the Western movies many of us grew up with, where you had the quick draw. You know, this is no longer stand in the street and, you know, count to three and draw. It's find a gun, pull it out and shoot the person. Hopefully when they don't know you're coming and they have no opportunity to defend themselves. And what's even more frightening is young people have learned to really shoot in the head and upper parts of the body now because so many young people started wearing bulletproof vests. So the lethality of violence right now is really escalating to the point now that most young people who are shot by guns end up really being paralyzed or severely injured if they're not killed.
You really teach your kids self-defense, and you also try to teach them what to do if someone is trying to hurt them. You sometimes ask this multiple-choice question. When someone points a gun in your direction but doesn't want to shoot you in particular, you should A, run into the nearest building, B, yell and scream while you run away, C, stand still, D, hit the ground. What's the correct answer?
Well, you know, the correct answer to this question is really D, and it's...
Hit the ground.
Hit the ground. And you know, it's really a shame. Young people really are not taught how to survive gunshots. And everybody else, every other military person knows when someone's shooting at you, you automatically hit the ground. And it presents the most difficult target. It prevents you from accidentally getting shot. It's really very difficult for someone to be shooting at somebody and accidentally hit you if you're on the ground. But unfortunately, young people don't know this, you know, and I learned this, unfortunately, the hard way in the South Bronx when someone was pointing a gun in my direction when I was playing checkers on a street corner. And I did the crazy thing and I ran right into someone else who had a gun out and thinking this person was coming. And it's just a miracle that I wasn't shot. And one of the older guys on the block told me, you know, in the way young older guys talk to young guys, you know, you're so stupid. Why didn't you hit the ground like everybody else? And I thought, well, you know, no one had ever told me that. How would you expect, you know, a young kid to know that that's what you're supposed to do? Constantly, what you find when you hear gunshots are children running and screaming, which poses really two real problems. One is that many of those children end up getting shot in the back by stray bullets that miss their target. The second thing, it ends up with lots of kids end up getting trampled as they really run for an exit. We have to teach young people really what to do, and it sounds so terrible to think that we have to teach young people how to hit the ground when they hear shots, but it is the only way that we know that on the street corners of our city that kids will survive when people come by randomly shooting guns. And of course, the real issue is that we need to get our kids off of those street corners. But at the same time, kids are so exposed to violence and guns these days that it's something that every parent ought to spend time telling children. Because I'll tell you this, the sound of a gun is so loud and so terrifying that if no one's ever really told you what to do, you're going to simply panic.
Well, your instincts are, get away.
Get away and run. And usually you run right where everybody else is running. And usually that's where the person they're aiming at is running at the same time.
You teach taekwondo, which is a form of martial arts. It's a Korean karate. How does martial arts help children with avoiding violence, which is your ultimate aim here?
Well, you know, it's so wonderful. I have these young people who come to me, and many of them come because, you know, there's somebody bothering them, and they're really looking for a way, you know, to beat this person up. And they say, you know, here's a person who could teach me how to, you know, go back and get revenge. And it's always, they're so disappointed because they come to me, and all of them want to ask this one question. And they call me Sensei, and they say, Sensei, have you ever had to fight with karate? And I tell them no. And they're all so disappointed. They're like, oh, because they wanted to hear these stories, how I disarmed these people, or I beat up 6 or 7 people. But I tell them that's the art. The art is, can you figure out a way to avoid violence? That's really what we're trying to teach. And they don't get it right away. But after a while, it becomes clearer and clearer to them the ramifications of violence. And especially in a handgun generation, where if people thought you knew martial arts, they would shoot you immediately. There really takes a while before the young people really find out.
Well, that's the thing. How useful is martial arts against guns?
It is totally useless. It is totally useless. And yet all of my students, they love the discipline of doing martial arts, even though they know there's zero possibility that they're going to probably end up defending themselves with this. But I'll tell you a little story which will demonstrate some of what I have to deal with in terms of martial arts. Now, I was giving one of my standard speeches last Monday to a group of my students about how they can't use violence, and anybody found using the martial arts, it's not a self-defense situation, and we define that when you cannot run away and you are trapped. That is self-defense. You have no way to avoid the situation. That's self-defense. So I'm going through this explanation, and after class, this kid, he's about 7, he comes over to me and he says, Sensei, there's this other student who's 9, right? So now we've got this big age difference, and so he's really justifying why I have to get involved. He says, and you know, he comes every day, he comes and he says things to me and he bullies me around, and he's also a martial arts student. He's a more senior ranking belt than I am, and I just don't know what to do. And I looked at him, and I know what he wanted me to say was, you know, I'll come to school and, you know, I'll go and talk to the kid. And I told him, you know, every time that happens to you, I want you to go home and I want you to do 15 push-ups. And the kid looked at me. I said, that's right. I want you to think that this young person who comes and every time he bothers you, he's giving you incentive to do 15 push-ups. I said, now you do those 15 push-ups, in about a year, you're going to be so strong that no one's going to bother you. And this kid's eyes lit up because he thought, you know, this might actually make some sense. I mean, if I use this disadvantage situation to my advantage, maybe I can avoid this. And it was a way, again, of avoiding a young person thinking the solution is, let me get someone more violent, more powerful to come and beat this other kid up. How can you turn that situation to your advantage so that you don't have to act violently, but again, can escape the violent situation?
Well, it's always seemed to me that in neighborhoods where people fight, that in order not to fight, you need to be strong enough to fight and win in order to walk away? Do you know what I mean? Like, if you're strong enough to have fought and won, had you chosen to fought, then you can maybe walk away and still be respected. But if you're not physically strong and you walk away, you'll just be seen as a coward, too weak to fight.
And this is the issue of becoming a victim. And this is really what children are really the most afraid of. And it really means so many children act so violently because what they're interpreting is everything I do, if someone thinks it makes me look weak, then I'll become a victim and everyone will pick on me. So one of the things we teach young people is how to be aggressive in saying, I don't want to fight. Not in a way that edges on a fight, but at the same time, takes a step away from a person and looks them right in their eye in a way that cowards won't do, and say, no, I'm not interested in fighting you. If you do that correctly, and it's a very complicated skill because it's very subtle, you can avoid most of that violence. But there's this other issue. It not only takes a certain amount of physical preparation, and so we give young people that. And it actually, when you're physically strong, you actually feel more confidence, and you exude this confidence that other young people realize means that you really could defend yourself. But there's a certain mental toughness that comes along with this also. And so it is building up the physical and the mental at the same time that I think is so important for young people.
Jeffrey Canada is my guest. He's the president of the Reedland Centers for Children and Families in Harlem and the author of the new memoir, Fist, Stick, Knife, Gun, A Personal History of Violence in America. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Jeffrey Canada, president of the Reedland Centers for Children and Families in Harlem, and the author of the new memoir, Fist, Stick, Knife, Gun, A Personal History of Violence in America. You tell the story in your memoir about how your mother basically taught the boys in the family that they'd better learn how to fight. One of your brother's jackets was stolen, and the older brother was basically told by your mother, you go back to the kid who stole the jacket and you get it back, or else I'm going to give you a beating.
This is something that I think that when I talk to many parents today of young people, this is this issue again of children being victimized. You know, my mother was a single mother. She had four boys, and her terror was that she would not be able to raise her boys so that we could really survive in the tough streets of the South Bronx. So she really looked for signs that looked like we were becoming victims on the street. And in this one particular time, I was too young to go in the streets, and my two brothers were out in the playground right down the block from us, and my brother John's coat was taken down. It was only a year separating my brother Dan from my brother John. And when John came back to the house and told my mother, you know, the boys took my coat, she looked right at my brother Dan and said, you let the boy take your coat? And all of us looked like, well, what could Dan do about this? And what is his role in this whole thing? And she told Dan, you're going to go back and you're going to get that coat. And Dan tried to protest, and we found out she was not hearing anything about protesting going to get that coat. Now, and Dan, when Dan didn't want to go, she told him, I'm going to beat you worse than this kid could ever beat you. And she meant it. And we were all stunned. And Dan had to go out, and, you know, he went and he got that coat, brought it back. And we all learned a lesson that day about really, and I tell people, you know, my lesson was as a young person, a little younger than them, that you shouldn't tell your mother, you know, when something was stolen, tell her it was lost. That was a better way. But we learned that, you know, we were really going to have to defend ourselves in the street, and we weren't going to be able to come and get our mother to fight our battles. Now, the problem with this kind of thinking is that while many parents and I myself ended up doing the same thing, years later, when I was an adult and my own daughter was in kindergarten and came home with her face scratched up and no one would help me at the school. And I felt so desperate that this my little girl had gotten scratched up by another girl and no one in the school would help me that I told my daughter, you know, you better not let anybody else do this. And I taught her how to defend herself.
What's wrong with it?
The problem with this is that it escalates. It just keeps escalating. And after a while, children begin to pick up bottles and children begin to pick up sticks. And really, we need the schools and other institutions to respond to parents' concerns for their children's safety. And all of our parents have to stop teaching kids to act violently. Now, at the same time, if you live in a very violent environment, and many of our parents do, and you can't be with your child all the time, you don't want your child constantly having their clothing and other articles taken from them. So it calls for really a community-wide response around this issue of violence. But it is a very dangerous thing. Because once you teach a child to act violent, there's really no more checks on it. You can't suddenly say, okay, now I taught you to act violent, but now I don't want you to act violent anymore now. You've gotten too big or something like that. Children just learn to act more and more violently over time.
You know, I know you've tried to make your schools and your centers safe havens. What does it take to do that? Do you use metal detectors, private security guards? Is that the approach you're taking?
Well, we really try to avoid those kinds of solutions because we don't think, A, that they're cost effective, And B, we don't really think they give a sense to young people of what we really try to stand for in terms of being creating a nonviolent community. And we don't try and be Pollyanna about this whole issue of nonviolence either and pretend that, you know, that we don't live in a very violent society. There are a couple of things that we think are really critical in dealing with this issue of violence. One is we have to identify the places where violence happens, and we have to put adults in those places. Two, we have to look at the corridors that children travel and make sure that there are adults actually looking out for children so that young people know what they can do and who they can turn to if they have a violent interaction. The third is we have to really inform the community that we want to stop this violence from happening. One of the things that we're doing in Central Harlem is we have something we call safety nights. And what a safety night is, one night a month, because we felt it would overwhelm the community if we tried to do it every night or every Friday night. But one night a month, we said, can we keep our children safe in this community when we know most of our children are being hurt? We did the research, talked to the police and the local hospitals. We found out most children in Central Harlem are hurt in the evenings between 5 and 11. Weekends are the worst times. So we said, let's take a Friday night or a Saturday night and see if we can keep all of our children safe for just one night. We have teach-ins. We've been working with the churches and asking them if they would open up their doors and not taking hundreds of kids, but can you take in 10 children? Can you just use the children in that community to form a little safe community for our safety nights? And we think that by informing the community, by organizing the community, it gets not only to the children that we're trying to change the issues of violence in the community, but it also gets to the adults. And they begin to understand that they have a role to play. That's connected with what's happening with children. And we try and reweave some of the fabric of community that many of us think we have lost in lots of our communities.
What about the schools and the community centers? You say you don't want to use the metal detector approach. How do you prevent kids from taking knives and guns into the schools and centers?
We decided that what we really needed to do was make sure that the young people who came to our centers understood that they were sharing this time and this space with other generations. This was not just simply going to be a youth community. The problem is if you create just a teenage youth community, teenagers are risk takers. They like taking risks. They look for the kind of excitement that adolescence often brings. So if they feel like this is totally their environment, they bring a lot of that risk-taking behavior with them to the center. We thought if we bring their mothers and their grandmothers and their younger siblings into this building, chances are they're going to see this as a place where they have to play the role as protector, not as the role of risk taker. So that we've really started programs that are intergenerational. We have parents coming into the center at the same time while our adolescents are there. You know, an adolescent is much less likely to swear up and down the hallway if he thinks his mother or one of his friend's mothers might be turning that corner any moment now. So it really, I think, brought a way of dealing with this issue of violence in a much more naturalized way. Young people in family situations do not act violently under most circumstances if families are mixed together. It also gives us an opportunity to connect adults with young people. There are many adults who live in our community who see every young person standing on the corner as a threat. When they go by, they clutch their handbags, they get really tense. They don't know who these children are. Many of these children are their neighbors. After they come to the center, they begin to form relationships with these young people so that they speak to one another. You know, it actually makes the whole community safer. Now when they're coming home after work and they're walking by this group of kids, you know, they're able to say, you know, how you doing, Ronald? And they say, I'm doing good, Ms. Grant. How are you? And you feel like people are looking out for you in the community. That's the way communities used to function. And we really think that that's the way we can get our communities to function better.
Now, you're doing your best to keep guns out of the hands of children. But you understand why young people sometimes have guns. In fact, you got a gun when you were in college.
You know, it was really, it just, every time I think about that incident, it just reminds me of how young people feel around the issue of needing self-protection. You know, we had grown up on Union Avenue in the South Bronx, and then we moved to a different neighborhood where I didn't know anybody. And, you know, New York has these waves of gangs that come and go. And this was during the early 1970s, and there was a gang movement again over in this part of the Bronx, and suddenly I was coming home. I was in college. I was away at Bowdoin College in Brunswick, Maine, the most peaceful, idyllic setting you could ever have a young person in. And when I would come home, there would be these groups of kids, and they were all 15 and 14 and 13, and they were members of a gang, and they were very violent, and they were very scary to me. And I used to go out of my way to make sure that where they were hanging out at, I wouldn't go down that block. I'd walk around a corner, go to a different store. And, you know, a funny thing happened. I was feeling so scared for my personal safety that I bought a handgun, and you could buy them legally up in Maine. And I brought it back to New York, and that gun began to change me.
How did it change you?
What I found was that at first when I would take the gun out with me when I would go to the store, right, and I'd say, just in case those crazy kids, you know, if they jump me, I'll have some self-protection. And I'd go around the corner to the store. And then after a while, I started thinking to myself, you know what? Why should I have to go around the corner? I'm not bothering anybody. I mean, after all, that store is close by. I should be able to walk right up that block. So I began to not go around the corner anymore. I began to go directly to the store, which meant I had to walk past the kids. And I would walk on the other side of the street. And then after about a week of carrying that gun, I said to myself, you know what? Why should I have to walk across the street? Why can't I walk down the side of the street, man? If those kids bother me, you know, I'm going to just have to defend myself. And so I'm carrying something, and I begin to walk through the street. But now when I walked right by those kids, I used to keep my eyes down and not look at them so I wouldn't cause any antagonism. And then after a while, I said, why should I have to hang my head? Why can't I just walk? Now, you know, without that gun, I would have exercised all of these other mechanisms of safety to keep me safe and out of conflict. But with that gun, it kept saying to me over and over again, why should you have to compromise? Why should you have to, you know, change your ways of acting? Why not just act just the same way you'd want to? And I realized that it wasn't going to be long before I was going to actually put myself in a position where I was going to be challenged. And I wasn't going to back down. I was going to call that challenge out front, and chances are I was going to end up shooting somebody. And that realization really changed me. And I realized I had to get rid of that gun. And then I took it to the dump out in Maine, and I got rid of the handgun. And I've never carried a weapon ever since. But I understand why young people carry guns. There is this sense that you need protection, but it is a funny tool. Once you put that gun in your pocket or you stick it in your pants, you change the way you act. You no longer avoid confrontation. You actually begin to seek out confrontation, and that's what makes these guns so dangerous for young people.
How long did you have yours before you got rid of it?
I had the gun for about maybe 6 or 7 months before I decided I couldn't keep a gun, that I didn't want to live like that, that I knew after a while I would be involved in shooting somebody and possibly murdering somebody.
Did your mother know you had it?
No. No, my mother did not know I had the gun. She would have been extremely upset if she had known I had the gun.
If she found out that you had the gun and she told you to get rid of it before you were ready to get rid of it, would you have kept it or dished it?
You know what? I would have kept that gun. And the problem is that you think your parents just simply don't understand. And I would have said, you know, Ma, you're not a man. You don't understand what it feels like. You don't understand how we have to deal with these kind of things. And then that would have been in my mind at 19 years old, 18 years old. That's really how I was thinking. And I find that most young people think that way. And then they think their parents just don't understand what they're going through. They have to have these weapons. Everybody else has them. And if they don't have them, kids are going to pick on them and victimize them. And after all, you know, most of these kids have so much invested in their self-respect, in terms of their ability to walk around and hold their heads up and not to be afraid, that they're willing to die for that. There's really nothing else they possess except what they consider to be their reputation. And if someone damages that, they're really ready to kill or to die for it.
Jeffrey Canada is the president of the Reedland Centers for Children and Families in Harlem. His new book is called Fist, Stick, Knife, Gun. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Jeffrey Canada will be back with us in the second part of our show.
Another day in the ghetto. 3 in the morning, everything is going swell. Yo, what the hell? That's the bell. Open up the door, it's my man. Yo, what's up, pop? Yo, have I got some bad news? Your brother's been shot. Damn, jetting to the hospital, praying for a miracle. Lord, I know he make it. See, my brother's kind of physical. Dripping with sweat, but I won't tell my mom's yet. See, mom's is under pressure, and she'll just be a wreck. Facing in the hallway, ran into the dock. Yo, doc, what's his chances, son? His chances ain't a lot. Peeked into the room, but I can't describe the pain. See, I knew it was my brother, but he didn't look the same. Somehow I got the nerve to put my hands upon his chest. Held the tears from my eye as I felt for his breath. And all I really remember is the words from my mother. My baby's gonna die, and now I miss my brother.
Damn. That's how it is. It's in the ghetto.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Jeffrey Canada. He spent the past 20 years working with poor inner-city children, children growing up in war zones. Canada tries to protect children, but his powers are limited. He'll tell us what happened when his fiancé's nephew was shot. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg listens in to talk radio. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. There are unconfirmed reports that some of the hostage peacekeepers being held by Bosnian Serbs are being released. The Bosnian Serb news agency says 58 peacekeepers were driven to Bosnia's border with Serbia, but the Bosnian Serbs say the UN soldiers will be released to Serbian control. This report, again, has not been confirmed. Meanwhile, the Pentagon is casting doubt over the fate of a missing U.S. fighter pilot. Electronic beacon signals, which might have been transmitted by the downed pilot, are no longer being heard. The pilot was shot down by Bosnian Serbs last Friday over northern Bosnia. A Danish court has approved the extradition of an American neo-Nazi to Germany, where he is wanted for the illegal distribution of hate propaganda. NPR's Dieter Berger reports from Frankfurt.
A Danish district court near Copenhagen said Gary Lauck could be handed over to German authorities because his publishing activities broke Danish anti-racism laws. Parallel criminal offenses in the legal codes of two countries is often a prerequisite for extradition. German authorities charge Gary Lauck has smuggled large amounts of neo-Nazi literature to Germany for two decades. German intelligence experts say Lauck is one of the chief suppliers of neo-Nazi propaganda in Germany. The 41-year-old U.S. neo-Nazi leader was arrested in March while visiting a Danish neo-Nazi group. Lauck will remain in a Danish jail pending an appeal by his lawyers. I'm Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
Federal agents in Atlanta have arrested more than 200 foreign nationals working illegally in the United States. The arrests are part of a campaign the Immigration and Naturalization Service calls Operation Southpaw. Bruce Dorton of Peach State Public Radio reports from Atlanta.
INS Regional Director Tom Fisher says Operation Southpaw is an effort to remove aliens working illegally in the U.S. and help American workers secure jobs. He says it was launched after more than 900 complaints were received in the past 4 months. Fisher says all industries are being targeted, and he says there are stiff fines for an employer who knowingly and willingly hires undocumented workers.
That person can be fined from the hundreds of dollars per individual up to thousands of dollars per individual.
Fisher says more than 130 federal agents from all the INS offices in the Southeast have been brought to Atlanta to assist in the effort. He declined to say how long the operation will last, but he did say it will be prolonged. For National Public Radio, I'm Bruce Dorton in Atlanta.
The Postal Service says it's raising rates for international cards and letters by about 10% starting July 9th. The increase does not affect domestic mail. The new rates are expected to boost post office revenues by about $10 million a month. On Wall Street, stock prices closed at a record high for the second straight day today. The Dow added 8.5 points to close at 4,485. Trading was heavy. This is NPR. The chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee says he wants to abolish the income tax. Texas Republican Bill Archer says he wants to, quote, pull the current income tax code out by its roots and throw it away so it can never grow back. Archer says the current tax code is too broken to be fixed. He wants to replace it with a broad-based consumption tax, either a national retail sales tax or a value-added tax that's levied at all levels of production. He held a hearing today in which a senior tax lawyer for Mobil Corporation said 2 years ago the oil company's tax work papers ran 146,000 pages long and cost $10 million to finish. In tennis, number one-ranked Andre Agassi has been knocked out of the French Open. Frank Verdeniga reports from Paris.
The world number one Andre Agassi has been surprisingly upset in a quarterfinal encounter against the ninth seed Yevgeny Kafelnikov. The Russian, playing a superb clay court game, grabbed his first Grand Slam semifinal spot with a 6-4, 6-3, 7-5 victory over an injured Andre Agassi. Thomas Muster, the fifth seed from Austria, produced another spirited performance to dismiss Alberto Costa of Spain 6-2 in the fifth set. And in the women's event, Steffi Graf took only 54 minutes to absolutely dominate Gabriela Sabatini 6-1, 6-love. Defending champion Arantha Sanchez-Vicario, Conchita Martinez and Kimiko Date of Japan also moved into the semifinals. For National Public Radio, I'm Frank Vardeniger at the French Open in Paris.
Russian officials have raised the death toll from last month's Sakhalin Island earthquake. 1,380 people died. Officials think there are more than 200 bodies still covered in the debris. The Russian Minister of Emergency Services says rescuers should still be able to find survivors in the rubble despite scaled-back operations. Authorities say more than 400 people have been pulled from the rubble alive. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the second part of our conversation with Jeffrey Canada. He's worked with poor inner-city children for about 20 years. He's the president of the Reedland Centers for Children and Families in Harlem. One of the programs he helped create teaches children how to avoid violence through conflict resolution. Canada also teaches children how to defend themselves with the martial art of taekwondo. Self-defense is something he had to learn growing up in the South Bronx. Canada has written a new book called Fist, Stick, Knife, Gun, A Personal History of Violence in America. You know, you are so able to defend yourself and so comprehending of the causes for violence and why children carry guns and everything, but that doesn't mean that your family is protected from all of this. Your book tells a really horrible story that your fiancé's nephew was shot and killed.
You know, it was probably for me one of the more devastating things that's happened in my life. This young person, he's a young man with a family, just standing on a street corner in Central Harlem, on a corner that I go to on a regular basis, and there was a kid who came out and he was trying to kill somebody right next to Alex and shot several times and really shot the kid up five or six times in the head, and one bullet missed this kid and hit my nephew. And you know, when we got the call, it was so devastating because my fiance Yvonne, when she told me that they had shot Alex, I was driving over to the emergency room and I was really, I said, you know, this guy, he was a handsome, big human being, strong, strapping young man. I said, the chances of one bullet killing him are just about nil. It hit him in his body, didn't hit him in his head. I said, don't be so upset thinking that Alex is dead. We got to the hospital, and the moment we pulled up, when I saw Alex's wife and I saw the other guys who were his best friend, I could tell that he was dead. And I just couldn't believe it. It was just stunning to me that just for no reason at all, made no sense, a young man like that could be killed. And it's happening all over this country all the time. And you know, the thing that I think, and it's probably, I mean, I worry about this. What really bothered me was it could have just as easily have been me. I mean, it was absolutely no reason I'm on that corner. It was absolutely no reason it was Alex versus anybody else. It seems to me that really shook me up, and it took me quite some time to really get over the fact of how at risk we all are because of handguns. This is just an issue of handguns being out of control and people using them, and it puts us all at risk.
Did you know the person who shot your nephew?
No. We only heard through the grapevine that it was someone from further downtown than Central Harlem. But I didn't know the person, and as best I know, no one's ever been prosecuted for that murder.
Jeffrey Canada is my guest, and he's the president of the Reedland Centers for Children and Families in Harlem, and the author of a new memoir called Fist, Stick, Knife, Gun, A Personal History of Violence in America. How much belief do you have in the system? In your memoir, Fist, Stick, Knife, Gun, you write about how when you were young, your brother went to the grocery store, brought back change from the $10 bill that he was given. He got robbed, and your family couldn't afford to lose the $10. Your mother called the police. Two police show up. They don't do anything. This didn't seem very dramatic to them. They didn't care. It went nowhere. They didn't even take it seriously. And you say you lost your confidence in the police right then and there. Did you ever get it back?
Well, you know, unfortunately, the answer to that is no. And people sometimes ask me, well, Jeff, don't you think that in your community that's, you know, has a lot of crime, you certainly need police? And the answer is absolutely yes. We do need police. We do need folks who are there to protect the community. But we need people who are sensitive to the community, who people who care about the community. You know, the problem with a lot of the police in inner city communities is that they're not from those communities. They just don't understand how those communities work. What they see is a kaleidoscope of the worst side of those communities, and they really believe that everybody in these communities are capable of anything. So they tend to treat those who are guilty of crimes and those who aren't guilty of crimes exactly the same way. And so it's very frustrating for those of us who live in the community to often have the police treating us as if we're the criminals. And it just really, I think, frustrates many citizens who believe that even when they do come, they honestly don't care. So we do need police, but we need police who care about the people there, who really feel that this is their community and they should be protecting it. Unfortunately, you know, the closer you are to these issues, the clearer it is to see that police are often acting in concert with many of the criminal elements. I live in the 30th precinct, which had a huge scandal for police who were involved in the drug sales and all kinds of crimes. And it's not uncommon. And, you know, every 4 or 5 years, they have some big scandal in the police department. Let me just tell you very quickly one of the real dangers with this. People know that there are certain members of the police forces which were involved in actually selling drugs. So if you called in a complaint against a drug dealer, we were all afraid that these police who were crooked inside the police force would tell this confidential source who you were and where you live. So people just felt they couldn't respond. And so that's the kind of, I think, lack of confidence in a police system that allows citizens not to really get involved in helping to make their own community safer by cooperating with police.
What do you tell young people when they have no respect for the police?
Well, I there are two things that I think that I tell them. I suggest a lot of our young people join the police force, and that seems sort of contradictory. But I think that if you really care about your community, then this is a way to serve the community. And it certainly should be something that young people should be encouraged to really go into the service areas of their community. The other thing, though, that I try and make it clear to young people that no one's perfect, but neither can you tar everybody with the same brush. We've made it a point, as a matter of fact, to know good beat officers. We get to know them. We develop a relationship with them. So we can say, you know what, don't go to anybody. But we know Officer Flowers, who happens to be this terrific officer here in New York. And him you can trust. He'll take it seriously. We know he's a straight guy. And it allows young people to understand that while you can be somewhat cynical, you shouldn't become a total cynic. There are people in every police force who are good, hardworking police officers who we can have relationships with, which will actually help you when you need them. Because, you know, this, you can have some very strong feelings about police, but let something happen and that you need a police officer and you want someone there who cares about your issue and is going to respond to it.
My guest is Jeffrey Canada, president of the Reedland Centers for Children and Families in Harlem. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jeffrey Canada, author of the new book, Fist, Stick, Knife, Gun, A Personal History of Violence in America. I'm interested in hearing what you have to say about Senator Dole's attacks against violent rap music and violent rap lyrics and violence in films.
You know, this is one of those issues, again, that I talk about in the book. And I think that gangster rap in particular, and I think we have to really separate rap from gangster rap, which gangster rap is really the hardest rap. It tends to be very violent, and explicitly negative towards women. And many of us find it really distasteful. And a lot of us have been fighting with the music industry for them to clean up this area of music. But what I've cautioned people with is that while we attack rap music, we let people like Sylvester Stallone and Arnold Schwarzenegger and these other people who make their living off of bringing mega violence into our communities, where I've actually seen children stand up, a whole theater stand up and yelling scream as these evil characters kill and maim. And you know what? In one film, they can shoot up 200 or 300 police. No one says a word. It's just pure entertainment. And it's just horrible that that's going. Let me tell you something that I'm worried about even more than gangster rap. There's this new movie coming out, right? It's this Morphin Rangers thing. Younger people will know what this thing is. And I've been watching the advertisement. It is the most violent stuff. It is all this martial arts with people kicking and beating and punching. And it's aimed at children. It's aimed at 5 and 6-year-olds. They love this stuff. We teach our young people to act violently, and the media is totally irresponsible in this. But it's not just rap music. It's all across the board when it comes to media. And I think that we have to tackle this issue. Mainstream, all of the mainstream movies, the mainstream record industry, the mainstream video industry, as well as the areas like gangster rap, which I think are as vile as the others, but not more vile. They are as vile.
What would you like to see the industry do?
I think that this industry really has to tone this down. That they have to, first of all, like the cigarette companies have never done, they have to admit that what they put on the airwaves, over the airwaves, actually impacts children. That actually does cause young people to act more violently. It's not the sole determinant of young people acting violently. I'm the first one to say there are lots of reasons driving this issue, but it certainly contributes to it, because the end message is always, you know, there's a point where you can't take it anymore, that you punch back, or you kick back, or you shoot back, and in the end, you'll be a hero. And that message comes from cartoons to major Hollywood studio productions. Even the most mild person, when pushed too far, ends up acting violently. I used to like to tell people about Mighty Mouse. You know, I hated mice because we had them all the time. But here it was, you know, these poor mice would be so tormented by this cat that after a while you couldn't wait for Mighty Mouse to come and beat this cat up. Well, it taught us that, you know, there was a point that when you were pushed, you needed to act violently to respond. And that was totally justified. We teach our youngest child that, and it gets reinforced all the way up the line. All of us have to act more responsibly, and the media certainly should play a role in doing that. And I don't think they ought to be censored, but I think many of us as parents can censor the media by making sure that we actually listen to what our children are listening to on those CDs, that we actually watch the same shows they watch when they watch videos and all the other movies they watch, and we begin to say to them, you know, I don't agree with that. I think that's bad. You should never let anyone talk about a woman that way. You should never let anyone say those kinds of things to you. One of the things that I heard, which impressed me so much, someone said, if someone walked into your living room and began to curse and say these horrible things about women and swear and do all of this stuff about murder and stuff, you would kick them out. But we allow this stuff to come into our living rooms every day, and our children have access to this, and we're not even having a conversation with our children about these kinds of issues. So I think lots of families have to get involved in this, but the media is responsible, and they have to admit that this stuff does have an impact.
In your memoir, you write that the only way to turn things around in America is for adults to start standing side by side with children in the war zones. What do you recommend exactly? I mean, what...
This is a, I think that's really a critical question, because, many times this violence happens and we don't see it. We don't know where it is. We don't hear about it. Our minister once said that he spoke to a drug dealer, and the drug dealer asked him, he asked the drug dealer, why are the children always coming to you and they won't come to me? And the drug dealer told the minister, because I'm there when they need me. They can't find you. If they need somebody at 10 o'clock at night, guess what? You're home in bed. I'm there on the corner. The young people come to me. We have to change that dynamic. We have to make sure that we're there when the children need us. That if there's an issue, they know of an adult that they can go to and say, you know what? Someone's out to get me. Or I'm worried about this. Or I need some help. When we're not there, it gives the young person no one to turn to, except those negative role models who tend to be the major players in our young people's lives. We as adults have to become those major players again.
One last question for you. Do you think one of the reasons why you've been able to work with young people in teaching them how to avoid violence and teaching them how to resolve conflicts without resorting to violence, do you think the reason why you can do that is because you can defend yourself, because you're physically strong, because you know how to fight, because you know martial arts?
Well, I'll tell you, it's one of the things that got me really so fascinated by this issue of violence, because I recognize that many of the young people who were coming to me really were coming to me out of fear. But I'll tell you this, you don't have to be a martial artist to really be a role model to young people. What young people really crave are adults who are there, who care about them, and who have some power. It's not physical power. As I say, I don't fight. I haven't beaten anybody up. I don't threaten children. I know if children are in a problem, I don't go in and say, well, I'll go beat the person up for you. With children want someone who can say, you know the kind of power I have? Let me make a call. Let me be the one. You're having a problem in school? I'll go there with you, and I'll talk to the teacher. What happened? Okay, let me go by your house. I'll talk with your mother. We'll see if we can straighten this out. This is the kind of personal power that young people need. You know, you want to go see that movie and you don't have any money? Come on, you can come with me when I take my child there. That's the kind of relationships that I think children really are looking for. When you're there, when children really need you, it makes it easier for you to get the kinds of messages. You know, we transmit our cultural values through interaction. And if we don't interact with children, we can't sit around as adults and say, you know, goodness, I don't know what's happening to the moral fabric of this society. I don't know what's happening to our cultural mores and our values. The children don't seem to carry them. Well, the children don't carry them because we were not there to pass them down. That is an active process, not a passive one. So the way you pass down those values and the way you pass down those morals is you spend a lot of time with children and they learn it from what you do, not from what you say. So my real push for this country is that we have to get reinvolved and reconnected with our children and give them an opportunity to see us in a variety of different roles as human beings and adults, and therefore to learn to mimic what we do and to model what we do and have a chance and an opportunity to see us as human beings who care about them and are part of their lives.
Jeffrey Canada, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me on, Terry.
Jeffrey Canada is the president of the Riedland Centers for Children and Families in Harlem. His new book is called Fist, Stick, Knife, Gun, A Personal History of Violence in America. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's the latest on the UN peacekeepers being held hostage?
Hi, Terry. We have a release. According to the Red Cross in Bosnia, 58 peacekeepers have been let go. 14 French, 43 Ukrainian, 1 Spanish peacekeeper. 121 were released last Friday. Many more are still being held. In other news, President Clinton is speaking out on the Republican proposal for welfare reform. He has a detailed critique of that plan. The Justice Department makes a deal with Philip Morris to remove cigarette display advertising from baseball, basketball, hockey arenas around the country. Also, NPR's John McChesney reports on the World Wide Web on the Internet.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. There are times when you're surprised by who you feel an affinity with, even if it's for a brief moment. That's what recently happened to our linguist, Jeff Nunberg.
I drive home from Palo Alto to San Francisco on Route 280. A beautiful road, it winds down the middle of the peninsula with hills and lakes on one side and glimpses of the bay 5 miles away on the other. It's usually the only time of day I get to relax and think about anything for more than 5 minutes at a stretch. Except that on this particular day, I wasn't interested in the view, and everything that was coming to mind was something that I really didn't want to think about. A problem with a real estate escrow, a defective computer monitor I couldn't get the dealer to replace. You don't want to know. My cassette player wasn't working, and I was in the part of the drive where it's hard to pull in any music stations. I for sure wasn't interested in listening to NPR. I can't concentrate on NPR when I'm in that kind of a mood. It's like Newsack. I started to punch up the AM stations. On the sports talk show, they were talking about the Warriors, which only made me more irritated. Don't even get me started on the Warriors. I pushed the scan button, and the radio started jumping its way up the band, and then all of a sudden I heard a man's voice saying, "You see, my friend?" That's all it took, just, "You see, my friend?" I knew I was right where I needed to be, one of those stations that's just for us angry white guys. That's the only place on radio where they call people my friend. It's the way you talk to somebody when you're trying to clue him in on something. Wake up and smell the roses, my friend. That's what C does, too. I mean the C that means, let me wise you up about this business, as in, C, that's exactly what Bill Clinton wants you to think, or C, these immigrants don't want to learn English. It's the word you use when you think that everything has a hidden explanation. It's not at all like look. Look is what you say when you're trying to resolve a disagreement, as in, look, I'll grant you the Warriors are in trouble all over, but they still could use a number two guard. People weren't saying look much on the show. Maybe there weren't many disagreements, or maybe nobody really cared about resolving them. It was more of an exercise in the pure syntax of indignation. The way I was feeling, I could understand this perfectly. It didn't have anything to do with politics. You can be ticked off at Clinton and the ATF, or you can be ticked off at the host and the callers. The important thing is that you get this agreeable buzz of irritation on. You feel a sense of community, like you're part of the great confraternity of ticked-off white guys muttering to themselves all over America. I listened to the callers. I listened to the ads for gold coins and vocabulary-building cassette tapes. They did a station ID that said that the station was the place that still cared about the working stiff. Right, I thought. I'm both of those. I was getting the hang of the syntax. Some guy called in with a story about how liberal photographers are always using motor drives and catching conservative politicians with their mouths open. I wasn't sure what the point was. I don't think the radio guy got it either, but he didn't pursue it. Whatever it was, it probably fit in somewhere. Typical, he said. Isn't that always the way? That's always the way, the guy said. You keep up the good work now. I had this urge to call the show on the special line they reserve for cellular phones. Let's go to Jeff on the car phone from the peninsula. What's in your mind, Jeff? I'd tell him about the problem I was having with my monitor. He'd listen to me, and then he'd say, see, that dealer has no intention of replacing that monitor. Right, I'd tell him. That's how I had it figured. Isn't that always the way? He'd say, you got it, my friend. That's always the way. Well, thanks, I'd say. Hey, you're doing a great job there. Enough already. When I crossed Route 92, I pushed the button on the radio. I could pick up the jazz station now. I started to feel better. On the left, the sun was slipping behind the hills, halating the fog that was pouring over the ridgeline. You look, you see.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Fred Landerl. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Kenesha Baker is our intern. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Living Language. Learn a new language at home or on the go with Living Language. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the heavyweight champion of the world says this is his final year in boxing. We talk with George Foreman, who made an unprecedented comeback in the world of boxing by winning the title at age 45. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.